Strange waited a moment, and then went to find Jeremy. "Why did not you tell me that he had been here before?" Jeremy made a sort of snorting noise of derision. "I believe I know better, sir, than to trouble you with such nonsense. Ladies in black dresses walking about in snowstorms. I hope you did not speak too harshly to him."
"Me, sir? No, indeed."
"Perhaps he was drunk." "Yes, I expect that was it. I dare say he and David Evans were celebrating the successful conclusion of their business." Jeremy frowned. "Well, I do not think so, sir. David Evans is a Methodist preacher." "Oh, well, yes, I suppose you're right. And indeed, it is not much like a hallucination brought on by drunkenness. It is more the sort of thing one might imagine if one took opium after reading one of Mrs. Radcliffe's novels." Strange found himself unsettled by Mr. Hyde's visit. The thought of Arabella, even an ideal, imaginary Arabella, lost in the snow, wandering upon the hilltops, was disturbing. He could not help but be reminded of his own mother, who had taken to walking those same hills alone to escape the miseries of an unhappy marriage, and who had caught a chill in a rainstorm and died. That evening at dinner, he said to Arabella, "I saw John Hyde today. He thought he saw you walking upon the dike last Tuesday, in the middle of a snowstorm."
"No."
"Yes."
"Poor man.
He must have been a good deal startled."
"I believe he was."
"I shall certainly visit Mr. and Mrs. Hyde when Henry is here." "You seem intent upon visiting everybody in Shropshire when Henry is here," said Strange. "I hope you will not be disappointed."
"Disappointed? What do you mean?"
"Only that the weather is bad."
"Then we will tell Harris to drive slowly and carefully."
"But he would do that anyway, and Starling is a very steady horse. It takes a great deal of snow and ice to frighten Starling. He's not so easily daunted. Besides, you know there are people whom Henry must visit, people who would be most unhappy if he did not. Jenny and Alwyn, my father's two old servants, they talk of nothing but Henry's coming. It's 5 years since they saw him last, and they're scarcely likely to last another 5 years, poor things."
"Very well, very well. I only said that the weather would be bad. That is all."
But that was not quite all. Strange was aware that Arabella had high hopes of this visit. She had seen her brother only rarely since her marriage. He had not come to Soho Square as often as she would have liked, and once there, he had never stayed as long as she wished. But this Christmas visit would restore all their old intimacy. They would be together among all the scenes of their childhood, and Henry had promised to stay almost a month. Henry arrived, and at first it seemed that Arabella's dearest wishes would all be answered. The conversation at dinner that evening was very animated. Henry had a great deal of news to relate about Great Hitherton, the Northamptonshire village where he was rector. Footnote 2. At the time of Strange and Arabella's marriage, Henry had been rector of Grace Adieu in Gloucestershire. While there, he had conceived a wish to marry a young lady of the village, a Miss Parbringer. But Strange had not approved the young lady or her friends. The living of Great Hitherton had happened to fall vacant at this time, and so Strange persuaded Sir Walter Pole, in whose gift it lay, to appoint Henry. Henry had been delighted. Great Hitherton was a much larger place than Grace Adieu, and he soon forgot the unsuitable young lady. Great Hitherton was a large and prosperous village. There were several gentlemen's families in the neighbourhood. Henry was highly pleased with the respectable place he occupied in its society. After a long description of his friends and their dinner parties and balls, he ended by saying, "But I would not have you think that we neglect charitable works. We are a very active neighbourhood. There is much to do and many distressed persons. The day before yesterday, I paid a visit to a poor sick family, and I found Miss Watkins already at the cottage, dispensing money and good advice. Miss Watkins is a very compassionate young lady." Here he paused, as if expecting someone to say something. Strange looked blank. Then suddenly a thought seemed to strike him. "Why, Henry, I do beg your pardon. You will think us very remiss. You have now mentioned Miss Watkins 5 times in 10 minutes, and neither Belle nor I have made the least inquiry about her. We are both a little slow tonight. It is this cold Welsh air. It chills the brain. But now that I have awoken to your meaning, I shall be happy to quiz you about her quite as much as you could wish for. Is she fair or dark? A brown complexion or a pale one? Does she favour the piano or the harp? What are her favourite books?" Henry, who suspected he was being teased, frowned, and seemed inclined to say no more about the lady. Arabella, with a cool look at her husband, took up the inquiries in a gentler style, and soon got out of Henry the following information: that Miss Watkins had only lately removed to the neighbourhood of Great Hitherton, that her Christian name was Sophronia, that she lived with her guardians, Mr. and Mrs. Swoonfirst, persons to whom she was distantly related, that she was fond of reading, though Henry could not say precisely what, that her favourite colour was yellow, and that she had a particular dislike of pineapples.
"And her looks? Is she pretty?" asked Strange.
The question seemed to embarrass Henry.
"Miss Watkins is not generally considered one of the first in beauty, no. But then, upon further acquaintance, you know, that is worth a great deal. People of both sexes, whose looks are very indifferent at the beginning, may appear almost handsome on further acquaintance. A well-informed mind, nice manners, and a gentle nature, all of these are much more likely to contribute to a husband's happiness than mere transient beauty."
Strange and Arabella were a little surprised at this speech. There was a pause, and then Strange asked, "Money?" Henry looked quietly triumphant.
£10,000, he said.
"My dear Henry," cried Strange. Later, when they were alone, Strange said to Arabella, "As I understand it, Henry is to be congratulated upon his cleverness. It seems that he has found the lady before anyone else could. I take it that she has not been overpowered by offers. There is something in her face or figure that protects her from a too universal admiration."
"But I do not think it can be only the money," said Arabella, who was inclined to defend her brother. "I think there must be some liking, too, or Henry would not have thought of it."
"Oh, I dare say," said Strange. "Henry is a very good fellow, and besides, I never interfere, as you know."
"You are smiling," said Arabella, "which you have no right to do. I was just as clever as Henry in my time. I do not believe that anyone had thought of marrying you, with your long nose and unamiable disposition, until it occurred to me to do so."
"That is true," said Strange thoughtfully. "I'd forgotten that. It is a family failing." The next day, Strange stayed in the library while Arabella and Henry drove out to visit Jenny and Alwyn. But the enjoyment of the first few days did not last long. Arabella soon discovered that she no longer had a great deal in common with her brother. Henry had passed the last 7 years in a small country village. She, on the other hand, had been in London, where she had observed at close hand some of the most important events of recent years. She had the friendship of more than one cabinet minister. She was acquainted with the Prime Minister and had danced several times with the Duke of Wellington. She had met the royal dukes, curtsied to the princesses, and could always rely upon a smile and a word from the Prince Regent whenever she happened to be at Carlton House. As for her large acquaintance with everyone connected with the glorious revival of English magic, that went without saying. But while she was greatly interested in all her brother's news, he had next to no interest in hers. Her descriptions of London life drew no more than a polite, "Ah, indeed," from him. Once, when she was speaking of something the Duke of Wellington had said to her, and relating what she had said in reply, Henry turned and looked at her with a raised eyebrow and a bland smile. A look and smile which said very plainly, "I do not believe you." Such behaviour wounded her. She did not believe she was boasting. Such encounters had been part of the daily tenor of her London life. She realized with a little pang that whereas his letters had always delighted her, he must have found her replies tedious and affected. Meanwhile, poor Henry had dissatisfactions of his own. When he had been a boy, he had greatly admired Ashfair House. Its size, its situation, and the great importance of its owner in the neighborhood of Clun had all seemed equally wonderful to him. He had always looked forward to the day when Jonathan Strange would inherit and he could visit Ashfair in the important character of Friend of the Master. Now that all of this had come to pass, he discovered that he did not really enjoy being there. Ashfair was inferior to many houses that he had seen in the intervening years. It had almost as many gables as windows. Its rooms were all low-ceilinged and oddly shaped. Many generations of inhabitants had placed the windows and the walls just as it had pleased them, without any thought to the general appearance of the house, and the windows themselves were darkened, every one, by the roses and ivy growing up the walls. It was an old-fashioned house, the sort of house, in fact, as Strange expressed it, which a lady in a novel might like to be persecuted in. Several houses in the neighbourhood of Great Hitherton had recently been improved, and elegant new cottages built for ladies and gentlemen with rustic inclinations. And so, partly because it was impossible for Henry to keep anything connected to his parish to himself, and partly because he was intending to be married soon, and so his mind rather ran upon domestic improvements, he was quite unable to refrain from giving Strange advice upon the matter. He was particularly distressed by the position of the stable yard, which, as he told Strange, one is obliged to walk through to get to the southerly part of the pleasure grounds and the orchard. You could very easily pull it down and build it again somewhere else. Strange did not exactly reply to this, but instead suddenly addressed his wife. My love, I hope you like this house. I'm very much afraid that I never thought to ask you before. Say if you do not, and we shall instantly remove elsewhere. Arabella laughed and said that she was quite satisfied with the house. And I'm sorry, Henry, but I'm just as satisfied with the stable yard as with everything else. Henry tried again. Well, surely you will agree that a great improvement could be made simply by cutting down those trees that crowd about the house so much and darken every room. They grow just as they please, just where the acorn or seed fell, I suppose. What? Asked Strange, whose eyes had wandered back to his book during the latter part of the conversation. The trees, said Henry. Which trees? Those, said Henry, pointing out of the window to a whole host of ancient and magnificent oaks, ashes, and beech trees. Well, as far as neighbours go, those trees are quite exemplary. They mind their own affairs and have never troubled me. I rather think that I will return the compliment. But they're blocking the light. So are you, Henry, but I have not yet taken an axe to you. The truth was that though Henry saw much to criticise in the grounds and position of Ashfair, this was not his real complaint. What really disturbed him about the house was the all-pervading air of magic. When Strange had first taken up the profession of magic, Henry had not thought anything of it. At that time, news of Mr. Norrell's wonderful achievements was only just beginning to spread throughout the kingdom. Magic had seemed little more than an esoteric branch of history, an amusement for rich, idle gentlemen, and Henry still somehow contrived to regard it in that light. He prided himself upon Strange's wealth, his estate, his important pedigree, but not upon his magic. He was always a little surprised whenever anyone congratulated him on his close connection with the second greatest magician of the age. Strange was a long way from Henry's ideal of a rich English gentleman. He had pretty well abandoned those pursuits with which gentlemen in the English countryside customarily occupy their time. He took no interest in farming or hunting. His neighbours went shooting. Henry heard their shots echoing in the snowy woods and fields and the barking of their dogs. But Strange never picked up a gun. It took all Arabella's persuasion to make him go outside and walk about for half an hour. In the library, the books that had belonged to Strange's father and grandfather, those works in English, Greek, and Latin, which every gentleman has upon his shelves, had all been removed and piled up upon the floor to make room for Strange's own books and notebooks. Footnote 3. The books Strange possessed were, of course, books about magic, not books of magic. The latter were all in the possession of Mr. Norrell. See Chapter 1, Footnote 5. Periodicals concerned with the practice of magic, such as the Friends of English Magic and the Modern Magician, were everywhere scattered about the house. Upon one of the tables in the library, there stood a great silver dish, which was sometimes full of water. Strange would often sit for half an hour peering into the water, tapping the surface and making odd gestures and writing down notes of what he saw there. On another table, amid a jumble of books, there lay a map of England upon which Strange was marking the old fairy roads, which once led out of England to who knows where. There were other things, too, which Henry only half understood, but which he disliked even more. He knew, for instance, that Ashfair's rooms often had an odd look, but he did not see that this was because the mirrors in Strange's house were as likely as not to be reflecting the light of half an hour ago, or 100 years ago. And in the morning, when he awoke, and at night, just before he fell asleep, he heard the sound of a distant bell. A sad sound, like the bell of a drowned city heard across a waste of ocean. He never really thought of the bell, or indeed remembered anything about it, but its melancholy influence stayed with him through the day. He found relief for all his various disappointments and dissatisfactions in drawing numerous comparisons between the way things were done in Great Hitherton and the way they were done in Shropshire, much to the detriment of Shropshire, and in wondering aloud that Strange should study so hard. quite as if he had no estate of his own, and all his fortune was still to make. These remarks were generally addressed to Arabella, but Strange was often in earshot, and pretty soon Arabella found herself in the unenviable position of trying to keep the peace between the two of them. "When I want Henry's advice," said Strange, "I shall ask for it. What business is it of his, I should like to know, where I choose to build my stables, or how I spend my time?"
"It's very aggravating, my love," agreed Arabella, "and no one should wonder if it puts you out of temper. But only consider,
my temper? It is he who keeps quarrelling with me."
"Hush, hush, he will hear you. You have been very sorely tried, and anyone would say that you have borne it like an angel. But you know, I think he means to be kind. It is just that he does not express himself very well, and for all his faults, we shall miss him greatly when he's gone."
Upon this last point, Strange did not perhaps look as convinced as she could have wished. So she added,
"Be kind to Henry, for my sake."
"Of course, of course. I'm patience itself. You know that. There used to be a proverb, quite defunct now, something about priests sowing wheat and magicians sowing rye all in the same field. The meaning is that priests and magicians will never agree. Footnote 4. The meaning was perhaps a little more than this. As early as the 12th century, it was recognized that priests and magicians are in some sense rivals. Both believe that the universe is inhabited by a wide variety of supernatural beings and subject to supernatural forces. Both believe that these beings can be petitioned through spells or prayers, and so be persuaded to help or hinder mankind. In many ways, the two cosmologies are remarkably similar, but priests and magicians draw very different conclusions from this understanding. Magicians are chiefly interested in the usefulness of these supernatural beings. They wish to know under what circumstances and by what means angels, demons, and fairies can be brought to lend their aid in magical practices. For their purposes, it is almost irrelevant that the first class of beings is divinely good, the second infernally wicked, and the third morally suspect. Priests, on the other hand, are scarcely interested in anything else. In medieval England, attempts to reconcile the two cosmologies were doomed to failure. The church was quick to identify a whole host of different heresies of which an unsuspecting magician might be guilty. The Maraudian heresy has already been mentioned. Alexander of Whitby, 1230s to 1302, taught that the universe is like a tapestry, only parts of which are visible to us at a time. After we are dead, we will see the whole, and then it will be clear to us how the different parts relate to each other. Alexander was forced to issue a retraction of his thesis, and priests were henceforth on the lookout for the Whitbyan heresy. Even the humblest of village magicians was obliged to become a cunning politician if he or she wished to avoid accusations of heresy. This is not to say that all magicians avoided confusing religion and magic. Many spells which have come down to us exhort such and such a saint or holy person to help the magician. Surprisingly, the source of the confusion was often the magician's fairy servants. Most fairies were forcibly baptized as soon as they entered England, and they soon began to incorporate references to saints and apostles into their magic. I never found it so until now. I believe I was on friendly terms with the London clergy. The Dean of Westminster Abbey and the Prince Regent's chaplain are excellent fellows. But Henry irks me. On Christmas Day, the snow fell thick and fast. Whether from the vexations of recent days or from some other cause, Arabella awoke in the morning quite sick and wretched with a headache, and unable to rise from her bed. Strange and Henry were obliged to keep each other company the whole day. Henry talked a great deal about Great Hitherton, and in the evening they played écarté. This was a game they were both rather fond of. It might perhaps have produced a more natural state of enjoyment. But halfway through the second game, Strange turned over the nine of spades, and was immediately struck by several new ideas concerning the magical significance of this card. He abandoned the game, abandoned Henry, and took the card with him to the library to study it. Henry was left to his own devices. Sometime in the early hours of the following morning, he woke, or half-woke. There was a faint silvery radiance in the room, which might easily have been a reflection of the moonlight on the snow outside. He thought he saw Arabella, dressed and seated on the foot of the bed, with her back towards him. She was brushing her hair. He said something to her, or at least thought he said something. Then he went back to sleep.
At about 7 o'clock, he woke properly, anxious to get to the library and work for an hour or two before Henry appeared. He rose quickly, went to his dressing room, and rang for Jeremy Johns to come and shave him. At 8 o'clock, Arabella's maid, Janet Hughes, knocked on the bedchamber door. There was no reply, and Janet, thinking her mistress might still have the headache, went away again. At 10 o'clock, Strange and Henry breakfasted together. Henry had decided to spend the day shooting, and was at some pains to persuade Strange to go with him. No, I have work to do, but that need not prevent your going. After all, you know these fields and woods as well as I. I can lend you a gun, and dogs can be found from somewhere, I'm sure. Jeremy Johns appeared, and said that Mr. Hyde had returned. He was in the hall, and had asked to speak to Strange on a matter of urgency. What does the fellow want this time? Muttered Strange. Mr. Hyde entered hurriedly, his face grey with anxiety. Suddenly Henry exclaimed, "What in the world does that fellow think he's doing? He's neither in the room nor out of it." One of Henry's several sources of vexation at Ashfair was the servants, who rarely behaved with that degree of ceremony that Henry considered proper for members of such an important household. On this occasion, Jeremy Johns had begun to leave the room, but had only got as far as the doorway, where, half hidden by the door, he and another servant were conducting a conversation in urgent whispers. Strange glanced at the doorway, sighed, and said, "Henry, it really does not matter." "Mr. Hyde, I—" Meanwhile, Mr. Hyde, whose agitation appeared to have been increased by this delay, burst out, "An hour ago I saw Mrs. Strange again, upon the Welsh hills." Henry gave a start and looked at Strange. Strange gave Mr. Hyde a very cool look and said, "It is nothing, Henry. It is nothing." Mr. Hyde flinched a little at this, but there was a sort of stubbornness in him that helped him bear it. "It was upon Castle Idris, and just as before, Mrs. Strange was walking away from me, and I did not see her face. I tried to follow her and catch up with her, but just as before, I lost sight of her. I know that the last time it was accounted no more than a delusion, a phantom made by my own brain out of the snow and wind, but today is clear and calm, and I know that I saw Mrs. Strange, as clearly, sir, as I now see you." "The last time?" said Henry in confusion. Strange, somewhat impatiently, began to thank Mr. Hyde for his great good nature in bringing him this. He was not quite able to find the word he wanted. "But as I know Mrs. Strange to be safe within my own house, I dare say you will not be surprised if I—" Jeremy came back into the room rather suddenly. He went immediately to Strange, and bent and whispered in his ear. "Well, speak, man. Tell us what is the matter," said Henry. Jeremy looked rather doubtfully at Strange, but Strange said nothing. He covered his mouth with his hand, and his eyes went this way and that, as if he were suddenly taken up with some new and not very pleasant idea. Jeremy said, "Mrs. Strange is no longer in the house, sir. We do not know where she is." Henry was questioning Mr. Hyde about what he'd seen on the hills, and barely giving him time to answer one question before asking another. Jeremy Johns was frowning at them both. Strange, meanwhile, sat silently, staring in front of him. Suddenly, he stood up and went rapidly out of the room. "Mr. Strange," called Mr. Hyde, "where are you going?" "Strange," cried Henry, as nothing could be done or decided without him. They had no choice but to follow him. Strange mounted the stairs to his library on the first floor and went immediately to the great silver dish that stood upon one of the tables. "Bring water," he said to Jeremy Johns. Jeremy Johns fetched a jug of water and filled the dish. Strange spoke a single word, and the room seemed to grow twilight and shadowy. In the same moment, the water in the dish darkened and became slightly opaque. The lessening of the light terrified Henry. "Strange," he cried, "what are we doing here? The light is failing. My sister is outside. We ought not to remain in the house a moment longer." He turned to Jeremy Johns as the only person present likely to have any influence with Strange. "Tell him to stop. We must start to search." "Be quiet, Henry," said Strange. He drew his finger over the surface of the water twice. Two glittering lines of light appeared, quartering the water. He made a gesture above one of the quarters. Stars appeared in it, and more lines, veinings and webs of light. He stared at this for some moments, then he made a gesture above the next quarter. A different pattern of light appeared. He repeated the process for the third and fourth quarters. The patterns did not remain the same. They shifted and sparkled, sometimes appearing like writing, at other times like the lines of a map, and at other times like constellations of stars. "What is all this meant to do?" asked Mr. Hyde, in a wondering tone.
"Find her," said Strange. "At least, that is what it is supposed to do."
He tapped one of the quarters. Instantly, the other three patterns disappeared. The remaining pattern grew until it filled the surface of the water. Strange divided it into quarters, studied it for a while, and then tapped one of the quarters. He repeated this process several times. The patterns grew denser and began more and more to resemble a map. But the further Strange got, the more doubting his expression grew, and the less sure he seemed of what the dish was showing him. After several minutes, Henry could bear it no longer.
"For God's sake, this is no time for magic! Arabella is lost! Strange, I beg you, leave this nonsense and let us look for her!"
Strange said nothing in reply, but he looked angry and struck the water. Instantly, the lines and stars disappeared. He took a deep breath and began again. This time he proceeded in a more confident manner, and quickly reached a pattern he seemed to consider relevant. But far from drawing any useful information from it, he sat instead regarding it with a mixture of dismay and perplexity.
"What is it?" asked Mr. Hyde in alarm. "Mr. Strange, do you see your wife?"
"I can make no sense of what the spell is telling me. It says she is not in England, not in Wales, not in Scotland, not in France. I cannot get the magic right."
"You are right, Henry. I am wasting time here. Jeremy, fetch my boots and coat."
A vision blossomed suddenly on the face of the water. In an ancient, shadowy hall, a crowd of handsome men and lovely women were dancing. But as this could have no conceivable connection with Arabella, Strange struck the surface of the water again. The vision vanished. Outside, the snow lay thick upon everything. All was frozen, still and silent. The grounds of Ashfair were the first places to be searched. When these proved to contain hardly so much as a wren or a robin, Strange, Henry, Mr. Hyde, and the servants began to search the roads. Three of the maidservants went back to the house, where they went into attics that had scarcely been disturbed since Strange had been a boy. They took an axe and a hammer and broke open chests that had been locked 50 years before. They looked into closets and drawers, some of which could have hardly contained the body of an infant, let alone that of a grown woman. Some of the servants ran to houses in Clun. Others took horses and rode to Clunton, Purslow, Clunbury, and Whitcott. Soon there was not a house in their neighborhood that did not know Mrs. Strange was missing, and not a house that did not send someone to join the search. Meanwhile, the women of these houses kept up their fires and made all manner of preparations so that should Mrs. Strange be brought to that house, she should instantly have as much warmth, nourishment, and comfort as one human being can benefit from at a time. The first hour brought them Captain John Ayrton of the 12th Light Dragoons, who had been with Wellington and Strange in the peninsula and at Waterloo. His lands adjoined those of Strange. They were the same age and had been neighbours all their lives. But Captain Ayrton was so shy and reserved a gentleman that they had rarely exchanged more than 20 words in the course of a year. In this crisis, he arrived with maps and a quiet, solemn promise to Strange and Henry to give them all the assistance that was in his power. It was soon discovered that Mr. Hyde was not the only person to have seen Arabella. Two farm labourers, Martin Oakley and Owen Bullridge, had also seen her. Jeremy Johns learnt this from some friends of the two men, whereupon he instantly took the first horse he could lay his hands upon and rode to the snowy fields on the banks of the Clun River, where Oakley and Bullbridge had joined the general search. Jeremy half escorted them, half herded them back to Clun to appear before Captain Ayrton, Mr. Hyde, Henry Woodhope, and Strange. They discovered that Oakley and Bullbridge's account contradicted Mr. Hyde's in odd ways. Mr. Hyde had seen Arabella on the bare snowy hillsides of Castle Idris. She had been walking northwards. He had seen her at precisely 9 o'clock, and just as before, he had heard bells ringing. Oakley and Bullbridge, on the other hand, had seen her hurrying through the dark winter trees some 5 miles east of Castle Idris, yet they too claimed to have seen her at precisely 9 o'clock. Captain Ayrton frowned and asked Oakley and Bullbridge to explain how they had known it was 9 o'clock, since, unlike Mr. Hyde, neither of them possessed a pocket watch. Oakley replied that they thought it must be 9 o'clock, because they had heard bells ringing. The bells, Oakley thought, belonged to St. George's in Clun. But Bullbridge said that they were not the bells of St. George's, that the bells he had heard were many, and that St. George's had but one. He had said that the bells he had heard were sad bells. Funeral bells, he thought. But when asked to explain what he meant by this, he could not. The two accounts agreed in all other details. In neither was there any nonsense about black gowns. All three men said she had been wearing a white gown, and all agreed that she had been walking rather fast. None of them had seen her face. Captain Ayrton set the men to search the dark winter woods in groups of four and five. He set women to find lanterns and warm clothing, and he set riders to cover the high open hills around Castle Idris. He put Mr. Hyde, who would be satisfied with nothing else, in charge of them. 10 minutes after Oakley and Bulbridge had finished speaking, all were gone. As long as daylight lasted, they searched, but daylight would not last long. They were only 5 days from the winter solstice. By 3 o'clock, the light was fading. By 4, it was gone altogether. The searchers returned to Strange's house, where Captain Ayrton intended to review what had been done so far, and hoped to determine what ought to be done next. Several of the ladies of the neighborhood were also present. They had tried waiting in their own houses for news of Mrs. Strange's fate, and found it a lonely, anxious business. They had come to Ashfair partly in case they were needed, but chiefly so that they might take comfort in each other's society. The last to arrive were Strange and Jeremy Johns. They came, booted and muddy, direct from the stables. Strange was ashen-faced and hollow-eyed. He looked and moved like a man in dream. He would probably not even have sat down had Jeremy Johns not pushed him into a chair. Captain Ayrton laid out his maps upon the table and began to question each of the search parties about where they had been and what they had found, which was nothing at all. Every man and woman present thought how the neatly drawn lines and words upon the maps were in truth ice-covered pools and rivers, silent woods, frozen ditches, and high bare hills, and every one of them thought how many sheep and cattle and wild creatures died in this season.
"I think I woke last night," said a hoarse voice suddenly.
They looked round. Strange was still seated in the chair where Jeremy had placed him. His arms hung at his sides, and he was staring at the floor.
"I think I woke last night. I do not know when exactly. Arabella was sitting at the foot of the bed. She was dressed."
"You did not say this before," said Mr. Hyde.
"I did not remember before. I thought I had dreamt it."
"I do not understand," said Captain Ayrton. "Do you mean to say that Mrs. Strange may have left your house during the night?" Strange seemed to cast about for an answer to this highly reasonable question, but without success.
"But surely," said Mr. Hyde, "you must know if she was there or not in the morning."
"She was there. Of course she was there. It is ridiculous to suggest, at least—"
Strange paused.
"That is to say, I was thinking about my book when I rose, and the room was dark."
Several people present began to think that as a husband, Jonathan Strange, if not absolutely neglectful, was at least curiously unobservant of his wife, and some of them were led to eye him doubtingly and run through in their minds the many reasons why an apparently devoted wife might suddenly run away into the snow. Cruel words? A violent temper? The dreadful sights attendant on a magician's work? Ghosts? Demons? Horrors? The sudden discovery that he had a mistress somewhere, and half a dozen natural children? Suddenly, there was a shout from outside in the hall. Afterwards, no one could say whose voice it had been. Several of Strange's neighbors, who were standing nearest the door, went to see what the matter was. Then the exclamations of those people drew out the rest. The hall was dark at first, but in a moment candles were brought, and they could see that someone was standing at the foot of the stairs. It was Arabella. Henry rushed forward and embraced her. Mr. Hyde and Mrs. Ayrton told her how glad they were to see her safe and sound. Other people began to express their amazement and to inform anyone who would listen that they had not the least idea of her being there. Several of the ladies and maids gathered round her, asking her questions. Was she hurt? Where had she been? Had she got lost? Had something happened to distress her? Then, as sometimes will happen, several people became aware at the same time of something rather odd. Strange had said nothing, made no movement towards her, nor, for that matter, had she spoken to him or made any movement towards him. The magician stood staring silently at his wife.
Suddenly, he exclaimed, "Good God, Arabella, what have you got on?"
Even by the candle's uncertain flickering light, it was quite plain that she was wearing a black gown.
Chapter 44. Arabella, December 1815.
"You must be chilled to the bone,"
declared Mrs. Ayrton, taking one of Arabella's hands.
"Oh, my dear, you're as cold as the grave."
Another lady ran and fetched one of Arabella's shawls from the drawing-room. She returned, carrying a blue Indian cashmere with a delicate border of gold and pink threads. But when Mrs. Ayrton wrapped it around her, the black gown seemed to extinguish all its prettiness. Arabella, with her hands folded in front of her, looked at them all with a calm, indifferent expression upon her face. She did not trouble to answer any of their kind inquiries. She seemed neither surprised nor embarrassed to find them there.
"Where in the world have you been?" demanded Strange.
"Walking," she said.
Her voice was just as it had always been.
"Walking, Arabella? Are you quite mad? In 3 feet of snow? Where?"
"In the dark woods," she said, "among my soft-sleeping brothers and sisters. Across the high moors, among the sweet-scented ghosts of my brothers and sisters, long dead. Under the grey sky, through the dreams and murmurs of my brothers and sisters, yet to come."
Strange stared at her.
"What?"
With such gentle questioning as this to encourage her, it surprised no one that she said no more, and at least one of the ladies began to think that it was her husband's harshness that made her so quiet and made her answer in such odd strain. Mrs. Ayrton put her arm around Arabella and gently turned her towards the stairs.
"Mrs. Strange is tired," she said firmly. "Come, my dear, let you and I go up."
"Oh, no," declared Strange. "Not yet. I wish to know where that gown came from. I beg your pardon, Mrs. Ayrton, but I am quite determined to—"
He advanced towards them, but then stopped suddenly and stared down at the floor in puzzlement. Then he carefully stepped out of the way of something.
"Jeremy, where did this water come from? Just where Mrs. Strange was standing."
Jeremy Johns brought a candelabra to the foot of the stairs. There was a large pool. Then he and Strange peered at the ceiling and the walls. The other manservants became interested in the problem, and so did the gentleman. While the men were thus distracted, Mrs. Ayrton and the ladies led Arabella quietly away. The hall at Ashfare was as old-fashioned as the rest of the house. It was panelled in cream-painted elmwood. The floor was well-swept stone flags. One of the manservants thought that the water must have seeped up from under the stones, and so he went and fetched an iron rod to poke about at them, to prove that one of them was loose. But he could not make them move. Nowhere was there any sign of where the water could have crept in. Someone else thought that perhaps Captain Ayrton's two dogs might have shed the water. The dogs were carefully examined. They were not in the least wet. Finally, they examined the water itself. "It is black, and there are tiny scraps of something in it," pointed out Strange.
"It looks like moss," said Jeremy Johns.
They continued to wonder and exclaim for some time, until a complete lack of any success obliged them to abandon the matter. Shortly afterwards, the gentlemen left, taking their wives with them. At 5 o'clock, Janet Hughes went up to her mistress's bedchamber and found her lying upon the bed. She had not even troubled to take off the black dress. When Janet asked her if she felt unwell, Arabella replied that she had a pain in her hands. So Janet helped her mistress undress, and then went and told Strange. On the second day, Arabella complained of a pain which went from the top of her head all down her right side to her feet, or at least that was what they supposed she meant when she said, "from my crown to the tips of my roots." This was sufficiently alarming for Strange to send for Mr. Newton, the physician at Church Stretton. Mr. Newton rode over to Clun in the afternoon, but apart from the pain, he could find nothing wrong, and he went away cheerfully, telling Strange that he would return in a day or two. On the third day, she died.
Volume 3. John Usglass. It is the contention of Mr. Narl of Hanover Square that everything belonging to John Usglass must be shaken out of modern magic, as one would shake moths and dust out of an old coat. What does he imagine he will have left? If you get rid of John Usglass, you will be left holding the empty air. Jonathan Strange, Prologue to the History and Practice of English Magic, Publisher John Murray, London, 1816. Chapter 45, Prologue to the History and Practice of English Magic, by Jonathan Strange. In the last months of 1110, a strange army appeared in northern England. It was first heard of near a place called Penlaw, some 20 or 30 miles northwest of Newcastle. No one could say where it had come from. It was generally supposed to be an invasion of Scots or Danes, or perhaps even of French. By early December, the army had taken Newcastle and Durham and was riding west. It came to Allendale, a small stone settlement that stands high among the hills of Northumbria, and camped one night on the edge of a moor outside the town. The people of Allendale were sheep farmers, not soldiers. The town had no walls to protect it, and the nearest soldiers were 35 miles away, preparing to defend the castle of Carlisle. Consequently, the townspeople thought it best to lose no time in making friends with the strange army. With this aim in mind, several pretty young women set off, a company of brave Judiths, determined to save themselves and their neighbors if they could. But when they arrived at the place where the army had their camp, the women became fearful and hung back. The camp was a dreary, silent place. The thick snow was falling, and the strange soldiers lay wrapped in their black cloaks upon the snowy ground. At first, the young women thought the soldiers must be dead, an impression which was strengthened by the great multitude of ravens and other blackbirds which had settled over the camp, and indeed, upon the prostrate forms of the soldiers themselves. Yet the soldiers were not dead. From time to time, one would stir himself and go attend to his horse, or brush a bird away if it tried to peck at his face. At the approach of the young women, a soldier got to his feet. One of the women shook off her fears and went up to him and kissed him on the mouth. His skin was very pale. It shone like moonlight, and entirely without blemish. His hair was long and straight, like a fall of dark brown water. The bones of his face were unnaturally fine and strong. The expression of the face was solemn. His blue eyes were long and slanting, and his brows were as fine and dark as pen strokes with a curious flourish at the end. None of this worried the girl in the least. For all she knew, every Dane, Scot, and Frenchman ever born is eerily beautiful. He took well enough to the kiss and allowed her to kiss him again. Then he paid her back in kind. Another soldier rose from the ground and opened his mouth. Out of it came a sad, wailing sort of music. The first soldier, the one the girl had kissed, began to coax her to dance with him, pushing her this way and that with his long white fingers until she was dancing in a fashion to suit him. This went on for some time, until she became heated with the dance and paused for a moment to take off her cloak. Then her companion saw that drops of blood like beads of sweat were forming on her arms, face, and legs, and falling onto the snow. This sight terrified them, and so they ran away. The strange army never entered Allendale. It rode on in the night towards Carlisle. The next day, the townspeople went cautiously up to the fields where the army had camped. There they found the girl, her body entirely white and drained of blood, while the snow around her was stained bright red. By these signs, they recognized the Deo'in Side, the fairy host. Battles were fought, and the English lost every one. By Christmas, the fairy host was at York. They held Newcastle, Durham, Carlisle, and Lancaster. Aside from the exsanguination of the Maid of Allendale, the fairies displayed very little of the cruelty for which their race is famed. Of all the towns and fortifications which they took, only Lancaster was burned to the ground. At Thirsk, north of York, a pig offended a member of the host by running out under the feet of his horse and causing it to rear up and fall and break its back. The fairy and his companions hunted the pig, and when they had caught it, they put its eyes out. Generally, however, the arrival of the host at any new place was a cause of great rejoicing among animals, both wild and domesticated, as if they recognized in the fairies an ally against their common foe, man. At Christmas, King Henry summoned his earls, bishops, abbots, and the great men of his realm to his house in Westminster to discuss the matter. Fairies were not unknown in England in those days. There were long-established fairy settlements in many places, some hidden by magic, some merely avoided by their Christian neighbors. King Henry's counselors agreed that fairies were naturally wicked. They were lascivious, mendacious, and thieving. They seduced young men and women, confused travelers, and stole children, cattle, and corn. They were astonishingly indolent. They had mastered the arts of masonry, carpentry, and carving thousands of years ago, but rather than take the trouble to build themselves houses, most still preferred to live in places which they were pleased to call castles, but which were, in fact, brewer, earth barrows of great antiquity. They spent their days drinking and dancing, while their barley and beans rotted in the fields, and their beasts shivered and died on the cold hillside. Indeed, all King Henry's advisers agreed that had it not been for their extraordinary magic and near immortality, the entire fairy race would have long since perished from hunger and thirst. Yet this feckless, improvident people had invaded a well-defended Christian kingdom, won every battle they fought, and had ridden from place to place, securing each stronghold as they came to it. All this spoke of a measure of purposefulness which no fairy had ever been known to possess. No one knew what to make of it. In January, the fairy host left York and rode south. At the Trent, they halted. So it was at Newark, on the banks of the Trent, that King Henry and his army met the Doyen Sidhe in battle. Before the battle, a magic wind blew through the ranks of King Henry's army, and a sweet sound of pipe music was heard, which caused a great number of the horses to break free and flee to the fairy side, many taking their unlucky riders with them. Next, every man heard the voices of his loved ones, mothers, fathers, children, lovers, call out to him to come home. A host of ravens descended from the sky, pecking at the faces of the English and blinding them with a chaos of black wings. The English soldiers not only had the skill and ferocity of the Sidhe to contend with, but also their own fear in the face of such eerie magic. It is scarcely to be wondered at that the battle was short and that King Henry lost. At the moment when all fell silent and it became clear beyond any doubt that King Henry had been defeated, the birds for miles around began singing as if for joy. The king and his counselors waited for some chieftain or king to step forward. The ranks of the Doyen Sidhe parted, and someone appeared. He was rather less than 15 years old. Like the Doyen Sidhe, he was dressed in ragged clothes of coarse black wool. Like them, his dark hair was long and straight. Like them, he spoke neither English nor French, the two languages current in England at that time, but only a dialect of fairy. Footnote 1. No one in England nowadays knows this language, and all we have left of it is a handful of borrowed words describing various obscure magical techniques. Martin Pale wrote in De Tractatu Magicarum Linguarum that it was related to the ancient Celtic languages. He was pale and handsome and solemn-faced, yet it was clear to everyone present that he was human, not fairy. By the standards of the Norman and English earls and knights who saw him that day for the first time, he was scarcely civilized. He had never seen a spoon before, nor a chair, nor an iron kettle, nor a silver penny, nor a wax candle. No fairy clan or kingdom of the period possessed any such fine things. When King Henry and the boy met to divide England between them, Henry sat upon a wooden bench and drank wine from a silver goblet. The boy sat upon the floor and drank ewe's milk from a stone cup. The chronicler, Odoric Vitalis, writing some 30 years later, describes the shock felt by King Henry's court when they saw in the midst of all these important proceedings a Deoin Sidhe warrior lean across and begin solicitously plucking lice out of the boy's filthy hair. There was among the fairy host a young Norman knight called Thomas of Dundale. Footnote 2. Variously, Thomas de Dundale or Thomas de Donville. It seems that several of Henry's noblemen recognized Thomas as the younger son of a powerful Norman magnate who had disappeared one Christmas 14 years before. Given the circumstances of his return, it is doubtful whether they felt particularly pleased to have him back. Though he had been captive in Faery for many years, he remembered enough of his own language, French, to make the boy and King Henry understand each other. King Henry asked the boy his name. The boy replied that he had none. Footnote 3. When he was a child in Faery, the Sidhe had called him a word in their own language, which we are told meant starling, but he had already abandoned that name by the time he entered England. Later, he took to calling himself by his father's name, John de Usclas. But in the early part of his reign, he was known simply by one of the many titles his friends or enemies gave him. The King. The Raven King. The Black King. The King in the North. King Henry asked him why he made war on England. The boy said that he was the only surviving member of an aristocratic Norman family who had been granted lands in the north of England by King Henry's father, William the Conqueror. The men of the family had been deprived of their land and their lives by a wicked enemy named Hubert de Contenton. The boy said that some years before, his father had appealed to William II, King Henry's brother and predecessor, for justice, but had received none. Shortly afterwards, his father had been murdered. The boy said that he himself had been taken by Hubert's men while still a baby and abandoned in the forest. But the Deoin Sidhe had found him and taken him to live with them in Faery. Now he had returned. He had a very young man's belief in the absolute rightness of his own cause and the absolute wrongness of everyone else's. He had settled it in his own mind that the stretch of England which lay between the Tweed and the Trent was a just recompense for the failure of the Norman kings to avenge the murders of his family. For this reason and no other, King Henry was suffered to retain the southern half of his kingdom. The boy said that he was already a king in Faery. He named the Faery king who was his overlord. No one understood. Footnote 4. The name of this Deoin Sidhe king was particularly long and difficult. Traditionally, he has always been known as Oberon. That day, he began his unbroken reign of more than 300 years. At the age of 14, he had already created the system of magic that we employ today, or rather, that we would employ if we could. Most of what he knew we have forgotten. His was a perfect blending of fairy magic and human organization. Their powers were wedded to his own terrifying purposefulness. There is no reason that we know of to explain why one stolen Christian child should suddenly emerge the greatest magician of any age. Other children, both before and since, have been held captive in the borderlands of Faery, but none other ever profited from the experience in the way he did. By comparison with his achievements, all our efforts seem trivial, insignificant. It is the contention of Mr. Norrell of Hanover Square that everything belonging to John Usclas must be shaken out of modern magic, as one would shake moths and dust out of an old coat. What does he imagine he will have left? If you get rid of John Usclas, you will be left holding the empty air. From the History and Practice of English Magic, Volume 1, by Jonathan Strange, published by John Murray, 1816. Chapter 46. The Sky Spoke to Me. January 1816. It was a dark day. A chill wind blew snowflakes against the windows of Mr. Norrell's library, where Childermas sat writing business letters. Though it was only 10 o'clock in the morning, the candles were already lit. The only sounds were the coals being consumed in the grate, and the scratch of Childermas's pen against the paper. Hanover Square. To Lord Sidmouth, the Home Secretary. January 8th, 1816. My Lord, Mr. Norrell desires me to inform you that the spells to prevent flooding of the rivers in the county of Suffolk are now complete. The bill will be sent to Mr. Wynne at the Treasury today. Somewhere a bell was tolling a mournful sound. It was very far away. Childermas barely noticed it, and yet, under the influence of the bell, the room around him grew darker and lonelier. The magic will keep the waters within the confines of the river's customary courses. However, Mr. Leaves, the young engineer employed by the Lord Lieutenant of Suffolk to assess the strength of the present bridges and other structures adjacent to the rivers, has expressed some doubts. The image of a dreary landscape was before him. He saw it very vividly, as if it were somewhere he knew well, or a painting that he had seen every day for years and years. A wide landscape of brown, empty fields and ruined buildings beneath a bleak grey sky. Whether the bridges over the Stour and the Orwell are capable of withstanding the more violent flow of water, which will certainly ensue at times of heavy rains, Mr. Leaves recommends an immediate and thorough examination of the bridges, mills and fords in Suffolk, beginning with the Stour and Orwell. I am told that he has already written to your lordship about this matter. He was no longer merely thinking of the landscape. It seemed to him that he was actually there. He was standing in an old road, rutted and ancient, that wound up a black hill towards the sky where a great flock of black birds was gathering. Mr. Norrell has declined to put a period to the magic. It is his private opinion that it will last as long as the rivers themselves. However, he begs leave to recommend to your lordship that the spells be re-examined in 20 years. On Tuesday next, Mr. Norrell will begin to put in place the same magic for the county of Norfolk. The birds were like black letters against the grey of the sky. He thought that in a moment he would understand what the writing meant. The stones in the ancient road were symbols foretelling the traveller's journey. Childermas came to himself with a start. The pen jerked from his hand, and the ink splattered over the letter. He looked around in confusion. He did not appear to be dreaming. All the old familiar objects were there, the shelves of books, the mirror, the inkpot, the fire irons, the porcelain figure of Martin Pale. But his confidence in his own senses was shaken. He no longer trusted that the books, the mirrors, the porcelain figure were really there. It was as if everything he could see was simply a skin that he could tear with one fingernail and find the cold, desolate landscape behind it. The brown fields were partly flooded. They were strung with chains of chill grey pools. The pattern of the pools had meaning. The pools had been written onto the fields by the rain. The pools were a magic worked by the rain, just as the tumbling of the black birds against the grey was a spell that the sky was working, and the motion of grey-brown grasses was a spell that the wind made. Everything had meaning. Childermas leapt up away from the desk and shook himself. He took a hurried turn around the room and rang the bell for the servant. But even as he waited, the magic began to reassert itself. By the time Lucas appeared, he was no longer certain if he were in Mr. Norrell's library or standing upon an ancient road. He shook his head violently and blinked several times. "Where is my master?" he said. "Something is wrong." Lucas gazed at him in some concern. "Mr. Childermas, are you ill, sir?" "Never mind that. Where is Mr. Norrell?" "He's at the Admiralty, sir. I thought you knew. The carriage came for him over an hour ago. I dare say he'll be back shortly."
"No," said Childermas. "That cannot be. He cannot have gone. Are you sure that he is not upstairs doing magic?"
Quite sure, sir. I saw the carriage leave with the master inside it. Let me send Matthew for a physician, Mr. Childermas. You look very ill."
Childermas opened his mouth to protest that he was not ill at all, but just at that moment, the sky looked at him. He felt the earth shrug because it felt him upon its back. The sky spoke to him. It was a language he had never heard before. He was not even certain there were words. Perhaps it only spoke to him in the black writing the birds made. He was small and unprotected, and there was no escape. He was caught between earth and sky, as if cupped between two hands. They could crush him if they chose. The sky spoke to him again. "I do not understand," he said. He blinked,
and found that Lucas was bending over him. His breath was coming in gasps. He put out his hand, and his hand brushed something at his side. He turned to look at it, and was puzzled to discover that it was a chair leg. He was lying on the floor. "What?" he asked. "You're in the library, sir," said Lucas. "I think you fainted."
"Help me up. I need to talk to Norrell."
"But I told you already, sir."
"No," said Childermas. "You are wrong. He must be here. He must be. Take me upstairs."
Lucas helped him up and out of the room, but when they reached the stairs, he very nearly collapsed again. So Lucas called for Matthew, the other footman, and together they half-supported, half-carried Childermas to the little study upon the second floor, where Mr. Norrell performed his most private magic. Lucas opened the door. Inside, a fire was burning in the grate. Pens, penknives, penholders, and pencils were placed neatly in a little tray. The inkwell was filled, and the silver cap placed on it. Books and notebooks stood stacked neatly or tidied away. Everything was dusted and polished and in perfect order. Clearly Mr. Norrell had not been there that morning. Childermas pushed the footman away from him. He stood and gazed at the room in some perplexity.
"You see, sir," said Lucas, "it's just as I told you. The master is at the Admiralty."
"Yes," said Childermas.
But it made no sense to him. If the eerie magic was not Norrell's, then whose could it be?
"Has Strange been here?" he asked.
"No, indeed." Lucas was indignant. "I hope I know my duties better than to let Mr. Strange in the house.
You still look queer, sir. Let me send for a physician."
No, I am better. I'm a great deal better. Here, help me to a chair."
Childermas collapsed into a chair with a sigh.
"What in God's name are you both staring at?"
He waved them both away.
"Matthew, have you no work to do? Lucas, fetch me a glass of water."
He was still dazed and dizzy, but the sick feeling in his stomach had lessened. He could picture the landscape in every detail. The image of it was fixed in his head. He could taste its desolation, its otherworldliness. But he no longer felt in danger of losing himself in it. He could think. Lucas returned with a tray with a wine glass and decanter full of water. He poured a glass of water, and Childermas drank it off. There was a spell, Childermas knew. It was a spell to detect magic. It could not tell you what the magic was or who was performing it. It simply told you whether there was any magic occurring or not. At least, that was what it was supposed to do. Childermas had only ever tried it once, and there had been nothing. He had no way of knowing whether or not it worked.
"Fill the glass again," he told Lucas.
Lucas did so. This time, Childermas did not drink from the glass. Instead, he muttered some words at it. Then he held it up to the light and peered through it, turning slowly until he had surveyed every part of the room through the glass. There was nothing.
"I'm not even sure what I'm looking for," he murmured.
To Lucas, he said, "Come, I need your help." They returned to the library. Childermas held up the glass again and said the words and looked through it. Nothing. He approached the window. For a moment he thought he saw something at the bottom of the glass, like a pearl of white light.
"It is in the square," he said.
"What is in the square?" asked Lucas.
Childermas did not answer. Instead, he looked out of the window. Snow covered the muddy cobbles of Hanover Square. The black railings that surrounded the enclosure in the center showed sharply against the whiteness. Snow was still falling, and there was a sharp wind. Despite this, there were several people in the square. It was well known that Mr. Norrell lived in Hanover Square, and people came here hoping to catch a glimpse of him. Just now, a gentleman and two young ladies, all doubtless fanatics for magic, were standing in front of the house, gazing at it in some excitement. A little further off, a dark young man was lounging against the railings. Near him was an inkseller with a ragged coat and a little barrel of ink upon his back. On the right, there was another lady. She had turned away from the house and was walking slowly in the direction of Hanover Street. But Childermas had the notion that she had been among the onlookers only a moment before. She was fashionably and expensively dressed in a dark green pelisse trimmed with ermine, and she carried a large ermine muff. Childermas knew the inkseller well. He had often bought ink from him. The others were, he thought, all strangers.
"Do you recognize anyone?" he asked.
"That dark-haired fellow," Lucas pointed to the young man leaning against the railings. That's Frederick Marston. He's been here several times to ask Mr. Norrell to take him as a pupil. Mr. Norrell has always refused to see him. Yes, I think you told me about him. Childermas studied the people in the square a moment longer, and then he said, Unlikely as it seems, one of them must be performing some sort of magic. I need to go down and see. Come, I cannot do this without you. In the square, the magic was stronger than ever. A sad bell tolled inside Childermas's head. Behind the curtain of snow, the two worlds flickered back and forth like images in a magic lantern. One moment Hanover Square, one moment dreary fields and a black writing upon the sky. Childermas held up the wine glass in preparation to saying the words of the spell. But there was no need. It blazed with a soft white light. It was the brightest thing in the whole of that dark winter's day, its light clearer and purer than any lamp could be, and it threw curious shadows upon the faces of Childermas and Lucas. The sky spoke to him again. This time he thought it was a question. Great consequences hung upon his answer. If he could just understand what was being asked and find the correct words in which to frame his reply, then something would be revealed, something that would change English magic forever, something that Strange and Norrell had not even guessed at yet. For a long moment he struggled to understand. The language or spell seemed tantalizingly familiar now. In a moment, he thought, he would grasp it. After all, the world had been speaking these words to him every day of his life. It was just that he had not noticed it before. Lucas was saying something. Childermas must have begun to fall again, because he now found that Lucas was grasping him under the arms and dragging him upright. The wine glass lay shattered upon the cobbles, and the white light was spilt across the snow. The queerest thing, said Lucas. That's it, Mr. Childermas. Up you come. I've never known you take like this. Are you sure, sir, that you don't want to go inside? But here's Mr. Norrell. He'll know what to do. Childermas looked to the right. Mr. Norrell's carriage was turning into the square from George Street. The inkseller saw it too. Immediately, he approached the gentleman and two young ladies. He made them a respectful bow and spoke to the gentleman. All three turned their heads and looked at the carriage. The gentleman reached into a pocket and gave the inkseller a coin. The inkseller bowed again and withdrew. Mr. Marston, the dark young man, did not need anyone to tell him that this was Mr. Norrell's carriage. As soon as he observed its approach, he stood away from the railings and moved forward. Even the fashionably dressed lady had turned and was walking back towards the house, apparently with the intention of looking at England's foremost magician. The carriage stopped in front of the house. The footman descended from the box and opened the door. Mr. Norrell stepped out. He was so wrapped up in mufflers that his shrunken little form appeared almost stout. Immediately, Mr. Marston hailed him and began to say something to him. Mr. Norrell shook his head impatiently and waved Mr. Marston away. The fashionably dressed lady passed Childermas and Lucas. She was very pale and solemn-looking. It occurred to Childermas that she would probably have been considered handsome by the people who cared about such things. Now that he looked at her properly, he began to think that he knew her. Lucas, he murmured, who is that woman? I'm sorry, sir. I don't think I ever saw her before. At the foot of the carriage steps, Mr. Marston was growing more insistent, and Mr. Norrell was growing angrier. Mr. Norrell looked around. He saw Lucas and Childermas close at hand and beckoned to them. Just then, the fashionably dressed lady took a step towards him. For a moment, it seemed that she too was going to address him, but that was not her intention. She took a pistol from her muff, and with all the calm in the world, aimed it at his heart. Mr. Norrell and Mr. Marston both stared at her. Several things happened at once. Lucas loosed his hold of Childermas, who dropped like a stone to the ground, and ran to help his master. Mr. Marston seized hold of the lady around her waist. Davy, Mr. Norrell's coachman, jumped down from his box and grabbed the arm which held the pistol. Childermas lay amid the snow and shards of glass. He saw the woman shrug herself free of Mr. Marston's grasp with what seemed like remarkable ease. She pushed him to the ground with such force that he did not get up again. She put one small gloved hand to Davy's chest, and Davy was flung several yards backwards. Mr. Norrell's footman, the one who had opened the carriage door, tried to knock her down, but his blow had not the least effect upon her. She put her hand upon his face. It looked like the lightest touch in the world. He crumpled to the ground. Lucas, she simply struck with a pistol. Childemas could make very little sense of what was happening. He dragged himself upright and stumbled forward for half a dozen yards, scarcely knowing whether he was walking upon the cobblestones of Hanover Square or an ancient road in Faerie. Mr. Norrell stared at the lady in the utmost horror, too frightened to cry out or run away. Childemas put up his hands to her in a gesture of conciliation. "Madam," he began. She did not even look at him. The dizzying fall of white flakes confused him. Try as he might, he could not keep his hold upon Hanover Square. The eerie landscape was claiming him. Mr. Norrell would be killed, and there was nothing he could do to prevent it. Then, something strange happened. Something strange happened. Hanover Square disappeared. Mr. Norrell, Lucas, and all the rest of them disappeared. But the lady remained. She stood facing them, upon the ancient road, beneath the sky with its tumble and seethe of black birds. She raised her pistol and aimed it out of Faerie and into England at Mr. Norrell's heart. "Madam," said Childemas again. She looked at him with a cold, burning fury. There was nothing in the world he could say to deter her. Nothing in this world nor any other. And so he did the only thing he could think of. He seized hold of the barrel of the pistol. There was a shot. An intolerably loud sound. It was the force of the noise, Childemas supposed, which pushed him back into England. Suddenly he was half sitting, half lying in Hanover Square with his back to the carriage steps. He wondered where Norrell was and whether he was dead. He supposed he ought to go and find out, but he found that he did not care much about it, and so he stayed where he was. It was not until a surgeon arrived that he understood that the lady had indeed shot someone, and that the someone was himself. The rest of that day and most of the following one passed in a confusion of pain and laudanum dreams. Sometimes Childemas thought he was standing on the ancient road under the speaking sky, but now Lucas was with him, talking of maids of honor and coal scuttles. A tight rope was strung across the sky, and a great many people were walking on it. Strange was there, and so was Norrell. They both had piles of books in their hands. There was John Murray, the publisher, and Vinculus, and many others. Sometimes the pain in Childemas's shoulder escaped from him and ran about the room and hid. When this happened, he thought it became a small animal. No one else knew it was there. He supposed he ought to tell them so that they could chase it out. Once he caught sight of it, it had flame-colored fur, brighter than a fox.